Okay, we're on.
This is Barbara Solarius from Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve, and I'm here with Mary Frances DeHart at Hart D Ranch in Salina, Alaska, and Karen Brewster from the University of Alaska at Fairbanks Oral History Program is also here. It is the morning of September 1st, 2016, and we're going to be talking today about Mary Frances, how she came to Alaska, and some of the experiences she's had here in Salina and in the general area. So if we could start just with where and when you were born and where you grew up. Talk a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born in Ohio, Millersburg, Ohio. Grew up on a large farm there and graduated from Ohio State University. The degree in home economics and then I got my teaching certificate in both home economics and art high school.
And then when did you come to Alaska?
Well, I first came to Alaska in 1961. Of course, my parents were here many years before that, but I was left on the farm to feed the livestock.
So why did your parents come up?
They came up. They were friends of Don, which was my husband, who passed away in 1977. And they helped with the hunting here at Salina. We hunted here. This is why it established here at Salina as guiding and outfitting headquarters.
And how did they get to know him? Do you know how your parents
Don, knew Don? Oh, yes. Don lectured in the winter throughout the U.S. on Alaska and set up all over the United States and showed at that time it was 16-millimeter films and narrated films. So he used our home as headquarters when he was lecturing on the East Coast. New York area, Pennsylvania, New York, and then a lot in North, South Carolina, Florida. So that's how I first knew Don, and of course both my parents were avid hunters.
And what were your parents' names?
Glenn and Frances Pugh, P-E-W.
I think we should say that some of the background noise is Yukon the parrot, and you have two little dogs also that might add a few little comments in here.
So you said you came up for the first time in 1961. Is that
1961, when you... I was still in college, so okay. I couldn't stay. Yeah.
So just for a visit?
Well, no, I all summer. Uh-huh. So I took the first summer, I think that was my freshman year in college, took the summer off to spend the summer here, working here, and then I went straight through college then, mm-hmm. summers, the rest, so I could get out early.
And so you came to work for Don DeHart,
yes.
And his guiding? What did you do for him?
Oh, mainly, I was working at that time we were across the road at the, he was leasing the DeWitt and trying to purchase the DeWitt estate. Mm-hmm. And also helped take care, we usually had from 20 to 25 head of horses.
And so were you here during the hunting season that first summer?
No, I had to return to Ohio to school. And Don was 18 years older than I. So I knew him from the time I was in really elementary school. Mm-hmm. But I don't know whether my parents usually were here every year in the summer to help with the camps. In the area here, we generally had three main camps, and we used solely horses. And we took not only hunting trips, but photography trips as well, and float trips on the Yukon River.
So when did you move up to Alaska more permanently?
The early 70s.
Okay.
Started moving. And from that time on, Mother lived here from that time too. So it was Mother and Don and I, and then Don... passed away with Lou Gehrig's in Mickey in 1977.
And the when Don would go to the lower 48 and do the presentations, was that intended to be like advertising for his guiding business?
It was some advertising as well as advertising Alaska.
Okay.
So it's a lot of, and I have a lot of the early filming here of when there were thousands of caribou, like crossing the, migrating across the Copper River from years ago. Yeah. So.
And then what kinds of things, when you were here more permanently, what was your involvement in running the business?
A part of everything.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, setting out the camp, putting out the camps, camp cook, helping as an assistant guide. And Don's illness was very short. He lived less than a year with Lou Gehrig's, but he was the longest patient at the hospital. At that time, it was a hospital, Faith Hospital in Glen Allen. So he was hospitalized there 10 and a half months. So Mother and I took 24-hour round-the-clock, had to take round-the-clock care of it.
And during all that time, you continued to run the guiding business?
I continued. Well, when he ended up in the hospital, it was just at the close of the season. We hunted not only in the area here, but we guided here as well as Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula. Wow. So it was when we finished a hunt in October in Kodiak that, in fact, he diagnosed himself, you know, what he had, because he didn't realize there was a problem until we got back into the town of Kodiak. And he was on, so I was thankful to have that 10 and a half months, because that time then I studied and got my registered guide license, so I would be the number 5 woman registered guide in the state.
So you were the 5th registered guide in the state?
Woman. 5th woman registered guide, yes.
Wow. Do you know who the first 4 were?
Oh, I don't, yeah. I can't list them at this time.
Elizabeth Hickather, was she one of them?
Yes, she was one, yes.
Okay. And did Don also guide polar bear hunting on the North Slope?
Yes, he did.
He did.
So that was the earlier years before polar bear was closed, and he used dog team guiding up there. I was never involved with, at the time I was in school, but my father was involved with that and helped with the dog team polar bear hunting.
Mm-hmm. And did they hire local native men to help
yes.
with the dog team?
Yes.
In what, Point Hope?
Point Hope. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And how about here? Did you hire local people to help with the different activities of the guiding here at this business?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Were hired as assistant guides here.
And how did Don, do you know how Don actually ended up here in the Slana area?
He was, you know, familiar with the state. Of course, he came to Alaska with the work for a short time with the Alaska Railroad, and then was head of BLM in mm-hmm. Anchorage for a short time, but was put into an office job, which he didn't care for, as head of BLM. So started guiding in the area first around Lake Louise and then up here.
Uh-huh. And the property that you have here, was it...
He homesteaded the property.
Okay.
In fact, he had filed on, where the visitor center is now, mm-hmm. all the surrounding 160 acres here was laid out by Don. But because he was lecturing and traveling in the lower 48 in the wintertime, did not have the time, you know, to really clear the property, the requirement.
Right, to prove it up.
Get proved up on the complete homestead, so he let an woman employee that was a cook prove up on the surrounding property. So it has since been divided. I've been trying to put together some of the property. I purchased like a couple years ago. It was divided up into separate plots, mm-hmm. like the 10-acre in behind me here, as a hotel property, because that was the final phase of development. Here would be the hotel and the restaurant.
Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your experiences actually out guiding and what that was like.
That was fun. Well, as I said, we used horses. Strictly, we did not have a plane, so backpacked in with horses. And also set up three main camps in the Copper area, Little Toke area, Mentasta area. And I said probably the major main camp was in Copper area. And
when you say Copper area, you mean up the headwaters of the Copper Lake, River?
Copper Lake. Mm-hmm. Copper Lake would be safe for the horses. It was a two-night trip in.
Mm-hmm.
So a little over 30 miles in, we'd use a Copper Lake area as the our first night,
your
second
base.
Night up into sheep country.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was too far for the horses for a one-day trip.
But so you would bring the clients from here, they would go those 2 days with
right.
you.
Oh, yes,
you
from here.
You didn't go set up camp ahead of time.
Main camp was set up, so we had big cook, you know,
sort of some
a
of the,
cook,
the
and
main
we always had a cook at each of the camps, full-time, okay. full-time cook. So they were set up ahead of time. But the hunters would come in to here, possibly stay a night or two here. Usually we're flown into here. When we could land, like either and taxi in where the post office is now, landing on the road here. And I think at that time, one of the air services, I believe, was Wilbur flying at that time, usually flying a 180 with passengers that would bring the hunters here. Sometimes they would rent a car and drive out.
And then how many hunters would typically be in a group that would go out?
Well,
on a hunt?
our hunts, the minimum hunt was 10 days, usually 15 to 21 day.
Mm-hmm.
And this one hunter, or usually one to two hunters.
Yes. So you would take one guy out on the 21
yes.
day trip?
Each hunter had their own guide. There was no groups.
Unless they were together.
Unless
themselves.
It was a man and wife couple,
yeah.
maybe there might be. They might be together.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, each hunter had their own assistant guide.
Mm-hmm. But then,
and from the main camp, we would set out what we call spike camps.
Can you describe what a spike camp is for
well,
people who don't know?
Maybe up in sheep country, say where they get out too far to really come back to the main camp at night, so they might just take supplies, backpack supplies, for a night or two to stay out before they come back to main camp.
So a tent.
Just in order they could be farther away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so you said each hunter had their own assistant guide, but back at those camps, you'd have more than one person. You'd have.
There might be, say four hunters, you know, at the same time,
right.
but each would have their assistant guide.
So
and they would have their sleeping tent set up there, as well as a large cook tent,
mm-hmm.
and there would be a full time cook at the main camp.
And then, how many employees did Don and you have?
Mickey. You got depending upon the number of hunters,
okay.
you know, there might be, I'd say, usually maybe 10 to 12 people around most of the time at one time.
And did certain people just guide and certain people just wrangle?
Right, we would have a horse wrangler usually as well.
Okay, we've got a phone. Okay, so we were talking about somebody you had hired who was just the horse wrangler.
There usually has to be just a horse wrangler. Taking care of the horses, getting ready, keeping them shod, and yeah.
And was that person often a local person or somebody?
No. Usually, no, there really were very few people living in the area. And it possibly could be some years, you know, that would change. For several years, we had people come up, like from Oklahoma, North and South Dakota, Montana, that, you know, were qualified and
from places with horses.
Could do these things, yeah. And would spend the summer here and maybe come up. They would usually be here in the spring because horses were wintered. When Don was living, usually we wintered our horses down at Fort St. John on Canadian pasture.
Oh, okay.
And then until I was taken care, of course, being here, it was just Mother and I running the business. So I did not have the time, couldn't leave, you know, to make the long trip down the Alaska Highway to Fort St. John. So I did the recent wintering was at Delta Junction with Dennis Green. And that was when, and I had Don had a BLM lease, and it was a 65,000 acre grazing lease that was within the park in the Copper area. And then when he passed away and I had my registered guide license, I was able to get the grazing lease for the horses. I still had the horses, but that lease was closed one winter just overnight. I think it was like January or February by the Park Service because it ended up taking precedence over the federal BLM lease. So I had no place to bring the horses back in the spring, which was usually in May that we bring the horses back. I would keep one horse here at the ranch, possibly two, so that I could ride, as well as if any of the horses, of course, usually once or twice during the summer, the leader would decide to come back to the ranch. So I'd be notified maybe that, hey, your horses are walking down the road. They would come out the 12-mile trail. And just walk down to the Besna Road, and at that time, always had a gate closed here at the, just so the horses
don't wander off
the gate. Yeah. And of course, then you had to have some way to take them back in. Of course, they were looking for a handout. But, of course, they had good grass and on their grazing lease, so no point, because if they were fed just for one night or anything, they were going to stay here.
So how come you didn't winter the horses here?
It was too harsh a winter to winter here. You can't keep water for 20 head of horses or feed. There's no, really, most of the feed, we bought the hay from Fort St. John, bought hay in Canada, mm-hmm. and trucked in.
I've heard that some people have left their horses up at Horsfeld and just let them roam.
The cat fell down.
Oh, I opened the window. That's why. Because of the smell.
I wanted to ask what kind of, how did the clients accept you as a woman guide?
Really, no problem. Most of my clients, you know, before they book, they knew me. I met most of the clients. In fact, we would usually be at their homes, you know, and booking for possibly. In fact, we had clients booked 2 to 3 years in advance. Mm-hmm. They were always booked. I say they were always booked at least a year in advance. Most of them 2 and 3 years in advance.
So they were repeat clients. These people
some
came
of
back.
Them were repeats, but most of them we met them at their homes.
So you knew them before they came.
Before they even came.
Before they arrived in Alaska, so they weren't surprised.
Right. So, how did you learn to hunt?
I grew up hunting.
So when you were living back in Ohio?
Yes. On the farm, we had to keep the... So I grew up hunting groundhogs, keeping them out of the hay fields. Yeah, squirrel and rabbits.
Yeah. Were there things that you had to learn when you came up here to be a hunting guide that were different from the hunting that you had done growing up?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Such because,
well, course, hunting, this was just hunting from, you know, your home, your home where you live there, just going out, you know, one day hunting, you know, for small varmint. And it was usually keeping the varmint down, you know, on the farm because of the broken axles and flat tires that they would cause the equipment. So here it was, you know, a whole different story, learning to cook on a Coleman stove or with a little wood stove, and learning to, well, a different kind of, completely different type of hunting, and learning how to pack, carry a backpack, and using horses as pack horses. Yeah, I've had a horse since I was 3 years old, but did a lot of riding in Ohio, but never did any packing. And a lot of that was learned through some of the clients that we had, such as Joe Back. He had made numerous trips, was a very good friend, and he's well known for as being the authority in the U.S. on horse packing. He has had numerous books out. Of course, he's been deceased a number of years, but like Horses, Hitches, and Rocky Trails, The Moose's Tooth, but he hunted a number of times with us.
And then did Don teach you things as well?
Oh, certainly.
So. I was wondering about tracking the animals and how you would know where to go find
right.
the animals.
Right. It was, just learning via Don. He was sort of an expert in that, yes. And we did some trapping in the winter as well.
So did he live here year round?
We lived here year round.
Except for when he was outside doing promotions.
Oh, yeah.
And once you moved up here and you married, did you go out and do those lectures with him?
I didn't do any of the lecturing. In fact, when I was in school, we went to many of the, I helped set up and so on.
You would travel.
I could to many of the, traveled along with my mother and father. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was a part of it.
And were there other, go ahead. I was going to ask if there were other guides in the area and what were the, did the guides help each other?
Really? We didn't have any close, there was no one, we didn't live close, operated completely separate. Really the only other guide that was in this area was Bud Conkle, but he operated a different type. They were different, completely different type outfit than the way we operated. He used an airplane, had a few horses, but it was mainly flying, so operated completely different.
What about Cleo McMahon? Was he guiding at that point?
He wasn't guiding in the area here, no.
And Urban?
Urban's on the other
Urban
side.
Urban O'Rahill was on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, no, there was really no one
and
around.
And the Ellis's weren't?
They were using plane and another completely, different area. Lee Hancock was the only guide that was, and he worked for us a good part of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Taylors did some guiding, Grizzly Lake, and they also came to Alaska working for us. So we did employ other registered guides, depending upon the number of clients we had.
And usually how many clients?
Like Wilson Justin was an employee, worked some. Calvin, Justin, Lena Charlie.
Yeah, I find this, the part of this whole story here, the guiding and that the Otna people worked as guides, I had not known that at all till I started this project, and I think it's fascinating.
And several of our employees as assistant guides, and they were employed just per hunt.
Okay.
For a specific client, not for the whole season or anything, like employed for 10 days at a time, 15 days at a time. We're from Mentasta, and such as Houston Sanford, Jenny Sanford.
So as the guide, what you say, you would take one hunter out. As the guide, did you also butcher the animal and carry it back to camp?
Oh, yes.
You had to do all that.
All the meat was brought back. Of course, if we had the horse, it was packed on the horses.
Right.
And, yeah. And our main hunting was for sheep and bear. You know, if a caribou or moose, you know, that was secondary. And we did quite a bit of fishing in between if the weather were bad or something like that. Most of the fishing was Copper Lake. And we usually kept a large boat at Copper Lake.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking before about the experience of being a woman in this business, what that was like, and did you interact with other women guides, or did...
No, there wasn't anybody. Well, other than the assistant, I work with Jenny and with Lena.
Mm-hmm.
We're the two women that we had.
But what was it like being a woman in that man's world of hunting?
No problem.
And you said interesting. You said your mom was a hunter too.
Yes, yeah, she hunted. But usually mom didn't go out guiding. She was cooking.
She was here at base camp?
Yeah. In fact, she did a lot of the cooking because we had to provide, when the people were here, the employees, the assistant guides, or people, like if we had people from outside, like the horse wrangler and so on, cat driver. Now, we had two small cats, and we used those to set up the main, to carry the heavy gear. And usually what we call blazo boxes, we would pack the wooden gas boxes and pack them on the trailers and take them into the main camp. That would only be like the main camp of the little tote camp, or just as far, you know, as covered to set up the main camp. Because there was so much, you know, in the way of groceries that the too much for the horses to pack in.
And... did you do that when there was still snow on the ground? It was frozen?
No, this was done usually the first part of August, getting camp set out.
Oh, okay. So sheep hunting is August, September.
Well, we get set up, so you're starting August 10th.
Okay. And yeah, I assume you were using canvas wall tents?
Yes. The big white canvas wall tents. And a stove in every tent. And the same way, the wall tents for sleeping. Of the clients, and they each had their own tents and a wood stove, and of course we would usually we would always start there before they got up, you know, that'd be part of the duty of the guides or the horse wranglers and so on, go in and start the fire for in their tent in the morning and take them coffee, and then they would come over to the main camp where there'd be table, and it was set up like a regular kitchen.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like any of the other guides, like that I mentioned, a couple in the area here, I don't know of anybody else that set up main. I don't know of anyone that had main camp set up and cook tents and a hired cook.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any other outfitters.
Well, I don't know. The Conkles were at Wolf Lake, but I don't know
they did
that time period.
Yeah, and they were down. I mean, time period when I know they flew in there,
right,
but they
right,
were
right.
over here at Cobb. They were over here at Cobb Lake.
Right.
And they flew over there, but still, it was plain.
Yeah, by that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had a few horses, but when we were hunting, it was basically all airplane.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Wilson talked about that they... Lee Hancock, that Wilson and Calvin continued to use horses later than other people.
So. Yeah, they had some horses.
Yeah.
they didn't do a lot of outfitting in the area here on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly when Wilson or when Calvin worked, they went. In fact, really, I'd say I can't even think of any hunts in the area here where they were, you know, that we employed them, that they were working here. But we'd have taken Calvin and Wilson, like, to the peninsula and to Kodiak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked to them about going to Kodiak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Calvin was telling me some stories.
Yeah.
And then Peninsula, yeah. Calvin, or I was going to say, yeah, going to Kodiak. Of course, that's in the spring. So you might be hunting on snowshoes there. So you take snowshoes because there could be snow yet. Probably is. The Peninsula was, you know, in the fall. And there was always a fly-in. We'd hired, so we would fly into the main camp there. Usually how we took things both to Kodiak and to the Peninsula, we had our stock truck, an F-600 Ford that, you know, could haul at least 8 horses. We would take that on the ferry to Kodiak, and we had our boat, load the boat and load it with gear, so we had our boat that we could hunt Kodiak and take everything, but flew the hunters across into camp. We didn't take any of them in the boat because it's sort of dangerous crossing.
Yeah.
You never know the weather. And the same way with the Alaska Peninsula. I said I remember it was a different experience out there because, again, you know, here it's a little hard to get lost. You know, you've got your mountains to guide you, you know, basically where you're heading, you can see, but it's easy to get lost on the Alaska Peninsula. There aren't any trees where we're hunting, and it's pretty much raining a good part of the time and wind blowing, so one knob looks like the next. And then you aren't going to have other food, like, say, if we were hunting in the area here, if caribou season or moose season, we would have the game meat then to eat. And we've even, you know, bear too. So we would have plenty of meat. So usually we grew, in fact, Mom had a huge garden here and grew most of our vegetables and packed that and take into camp. So, but on the peninsula, because of the weather, you never know when you can get out, you know, and that was always a challenge, having other hunters, because these hunters have a strict time schedule. Well, I've got to be home by such and such a time. Well, one says, you know, maybe it isn't going to happen. You don't have to be any place at any certain time. and I had to watch. I had a separate cook tent, but usually I slept with a lot of the food because maybe they would stay up late at night telling stories or whatever, playing cards and so on while they're looking for snacks. But that was one challenge as a cook, which usually I was a cook there on the peninsula. You had to manage your food allotment and at least have enough for maybe a week, because it may be a week longer than you intended to be there. And maybe the plane could get maybe part of you out, and you may not be able to come back to get the rest of you out. So you're going to have food and keep enough on hand. So I'd be sleeping with a can of bars and bread and everything else. So the clients didn't eat it, or the guides eat the food.
Right.
So we had enough to make do.
A lot of planning goes into organizing hunting trips.
Yeah.
For sure.
So I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
After Don passed away, you continued with the business.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that, running it on your own?
Right. Well, basically, after I got my guide license, of course, I knew, you know, what I was doing. I then had to hire more help and register guides, but set out the same camps, and we had, like, I had hunters booked 3 years ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, after the medical expense with Don, I was strapped with a tremendous amount of expense. And I had no, you know, what do you do? I had really no choice but what to continue the business as we had so much invested in the property here. So it's been, and I'm still struggling, you know, with the financial burden of everything. So the only choice I had was to redesign everything so that I could, in some form, so that I can make a living here. And because, you know, being self-employed all your life in this area, again, that wasn't easy. And Don helped me get started. Of course, I am an artist, and but I hadn't done bronze until really Don insisted here. He was friends with a lot of the Western sculptors, the Western U.S. sculptors. And, you know, in our travels and meeting with possible clients, he introduced me to a lot of the sculptors. And we researched foundries in the West as well. And he basically, the reason I hadn't really pursued bronze, except, you know, it was at his insistence, was because of the expense involved. And you've just got such a tremendous expense in the making of a piece. For instance, a mold is going to cost usually a minimum of $2,000 in the first place. So you've got to come up with several, quite a bit of, to get the pieces cast and to making the molds and so on. And again, I was facing another challenge of how do you do this in Alaska? I could do the original, but how, there's no foundries in Alaska. How are you going to get the original to the foundry? So I decided on Arizona as being the most convenient, and there were some good foundries there. I started in Prescott, Arizona, but then found it was too hard to get in and out of Prescott, that it was much easier. Phoenix was much easier with direct flights. So that's why I started, and that helped. So it took a lot of different things to help supplement the income. It was not only the guiding and the outfitting, but then it was the post office that supplemented to help. So when they decided to put a post office in the area here, that was in 1977. Of course, there was the original post office was over at the Solana Roadhouse, which is across. And at that time, when I was first here, that was where Harty Ranch was located. And we would have, you know, continued there. However, was not able to come to a agreement with the DeWitt that was at that time owned by four, the family, the brothers and the sisters, as old man DeWitt had disappeared. And didn't know whether he had left. It never was, you know, don't know whether he died in the river or whether he left or what happened. But anyway, it was his, tied up as part of the estate and couldn't come to an agreement. So at that time, then we started building here.
In what year was that you started building the current?
I guess, say 59, 61, we were clearing the land here. When it was here, still clearing. And okay. Yeah.
So when you first came up here, they were starting to everything. Clear the land.
Right. I was still over at the DeWitts.
Right. Mm-hmm. And when did you start having clients staying here at this Harty Ranch Lodge?
I guess, I don't know what year it was. I'm going to say in the 65, let's see, time I got up here, of course, this was just the main house, and I've added on just this part right here. Right. I've added on all the rest of it. Yeah. Okay. I was going to say the early, late 60s, 68, something like that. Yeah.
And you talked a little bit about at the beginning about how your business had been impacted by the park. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Repeat that again. How?
You talked a little bit about when the park was established, how it affected the business.
Oh, yeah. It basically took the business. I lost everything. I had to sell horses, which I didn't have an opportunity to get, you know, the price that I should have for the horses, because I didn't see the horses after I took them up for wintering, say the 1st of October, and they were at Delta at the time. So where I was wintering, I just ended up selling them where they were at the area there. So I had nothing. It helped. So then I did get the contract for the post office, but I had to build a building. They let me temporarily use the what we used as the summer bunkhouse. So I used that temporarily, one room over there, as a post office. Of course, it was pretty cold. You know, it isn't insulated for winter use, so it was pretty cold in wintertime. But which, of course, the post office at that time was open Tuesday and Thursday. And Mother, she wanted the post office. She operated the post office. She solely operated the post office. And then it took me, I don't know, 2.5 years, say, to build the building, because I physically myself pulled in all the logs with my cat, a little case, 310. So from across, I bought them, you know, from over by the Copper River and in behind here. So I cut and pulled in all the logs and got up all the walls. I did have to have, I had some friends of my family come up to help get the ridge up and to do the roof and so on. But most of the logs and, in fact, we had a log peeling contest, and the people from the hospital where Don was, so it was summer missionaries, came up and we had a fish fry, and I said, okay, how are we going to get all these logs peeled? So we took a weekend and got the logs peeled with about 30 people.
It's fabulous.
So it's my understanding that there's hunting still in the preserve, correct?
So
how is it that the park coming in...
We did not hunt on that side. We hunted on
the area where they were hunting.
What we call the hard park, and where the grazing lease area was.
Was within the park boundaries.
Right, was in the park, the Copper area, and the grazing lease went for about 3 miles across the Copper River as well.
And so you had an exclusive guide area
at that time, yes.
Do you remember when that came in? And
No.
Well, I guess my question is, the change from just being able to go anywhere to having your exclusive area.
Probably the exclusive area was, I think it was just before Don dies, I'm going to say 75, 76.
Do you remember how that felt for the business, and did it change the way you guys did things?
No, except it limited. You could only have 3 exclusive guide areas. And so I had a guide area in units 11, 12, and 13 here, plus Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula. And so I gave up, basically. They wanted me to keep, I kept Kodiak, I hunted Kodiak, but I didn't go back myself to the peninsula after Don died. We did continue, I had hunter's book for Kodiak. We used horses there as well. I leased horses from there were a couple ranchers that had horses on Kodiak and leased horses there.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the change to exclusive areas was as big an impact as the park was.
No. I was granted the same exclusive areas and here, so that didn't have an impact. No, it was a park that put completely out of business, because we had to have all 3 camps together. Like the little toe camp was some sheep hunting, but it was mainly, we moved them like from Copper to Little Toke, say if they were hunting moose, so it might be better in the Little Toke or Mentasta area for moose. Sheep was more the Copper and some the Little Toke area.
Yeah, and all of that got encompassed by the park boundary.
Right. So basically, you know, put me out of business completely. And then you don't have, when that is your only, you know, your full-time business, so you don't have the money to do anything else either.
Right.
And, of course, all the time that I was here, you know, I was completely self-sufficient. There weren't services or anything. It was on generator. We did have generator, but ran generator 24/7. The other biggest impact here has been the incoming of power, to my disadvantage.
How so?
Oh, it's doubled my expense.
Hmm. Really? So having power brought in is more expensive than using a generator?
Certainly for me, yes.
Wow.
Because I heated with my generator. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been had they had the power that they were bringing into the area, had they done what the original plan was to connect it to TOPE, but now we're paying over double what Glen Allen pays, and it averages right at 26 cents a kilowatt more than what TOPE pays. Mm-hmm. Because somehow this highway, they managed to call it a village. Mm-hmm. And right now it's just, you know, strictly diesel. And the thing is, I heated with my generators. I lost my heat source.
Right.
So, when they were, so that's been a big impact, right, when they were burnt.
Right. And, you know, all these challenges, you know, with Don dying and you taking over the business and trying to find all these ways to make money, what motivated you to stay here? Why didn't you just pick up and go back to Ohio or someplace else?
I have no family in Ohio, so right now I have no living relatives. Mm-hmm. I have no one. And, you know, your life is invested here. So you got to have something. How are you going to, where are you going to move? You got to have something to live on. This was the only place that I had of making enough, you know, to pay the monthly of what I could do myself, mm-hmm, to make a self-employed living when you're self-employed. So you have no retirement.
Why did you want to continue to be self-employed and live out here?
How can you change anything, you know, at 60 years old, say?
I was thinking at the time when Don passed away and you chose to continue to live here.
Well, still, you didn't have the funds, you know. Yeah. You didn't have any funds to go anyplace. I've lost the horses, you lost the business. So the only thing I could do was, you had the property here, was to figure out, okay, how can you make a living with the property that's here?
Right.
So I was taking a chance that hopefully, okay, with the park, because I knew that there's a few people coming now with motorhomes. That had just become the end thing, I guess, to have campers and motorhomes. Well, they were wanting a place to park. Okay, so, and I've had a few to park here, and then there's some of the construction wanting a place to park. So, thought with that, so it just takes a little bit of everything. My artwork, so it took my art in order to make a living. But, of course, basically with the death of Don, that took my art. And with the death, because, well, I did remarry and was remarried for 11 years. To Ed Bjorn, but he died in 1999, at the same, just within a few months of my mother. And neither one of them were sick. Both died quite suddenly. Mother was still working. Ed was. So I lost everything there.
You had to start over once again.
Yeah. And I had no way that I was still doing my artwork, because in order to do the sculpture, which I had become quite successful, I showed in galleries in Scottsdale and some galleries in Texas, about three different places in the U.S. I didn't show at any galleries here in Alaska because I was having more success right here. So I had my own gallery right here and basically made most of my sales from right here. Or, you know, taking them into Anchorage through business contacts that I knew. But and I was able, because I had to be able to travel to the foundry. What I did, I would make my first mold it's lost wax casting, so I would make the first mold here, because I tried sending one original to the foundry. It was destroyed. Didn't get there, so that there's no way of doing this, so I have to make the molds here. So I learned to make the mold, so I pour my hollow waxes here, make the silicone mold and make the plaster mold, and pour the hollow wax, which is identical to the bronze. And then with the hollow wax poured, by building large wooden boxes and encasing them in foam. I was able to ship them via Alaska Airlines. They would send refrigerated that I could hold the wax, but I would have to then either drive down or fly down and be there. Might be 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever time it took to do the to help with the casting and to help on the metal chasing to get the pieces, because the foundry has never seen the piece, and I had to help to assemble and get them back together. And so, you know, I'd be going down to Phoenix, but as long as Mother, there had to be somebody here 24/7, so Mother and Ed was here. So all of our traveling, you know, I've been used to, you know, traveling back and forth to Anchorage and so on for supplies, and this has always been, you know, one at a time, because people have to, somebody has to be here all the time at all times. So even to Phoenix, I would always go alone. I made several trips driving in order to bring pieces back. But I haven't been able to do any casting since Ed and Mom died, because I can't leave. It's been over a year since I've been to town, which is Anchorage.
Right. Why have you chosen not to hire people to help you?
There's no one here to hire that I can leave in a care to take care of things. There isn't anyone. I have a temporary help, but that, you know, she on rare occasions will take and do the post office, but she has to stay here. And with people having their own family, otherwise, you know, there just isn't people in the area.
Speaking of people in the area, sort of a segue a little bit. We've been just talking about the difficulties and challenges. What's positive about living here? What makes this a nice place to live?
Well, I guess you think it's remote, but I don't know how many hundreds of people I've had here this summer. I do meet a lot of people. Of course, they're just passers-by. I'll probably never see them again. Well, some of them I do, but some of them are, yeah, I'm getting, this year I did get a number of return customers.
So you have rooms that people can stay in now?
I have large rooms, and I have the 43
and,
RV
and
spaces.
The RV spaces.
Mm-hmm. And I'm concentrating more on the rooms. It's easier for me to take care of.
Right. But so the whole time, you know, since the 60s when you started coming up here to now, have there been changes in this area?
Oh, major.
Such as?
I think probably I've touched on most of these, but it's the, it's like the changes with the number of people. I just can't believe the amount of traffic that's on this road now. And it was like, you know, I ran dogs for many years, had dog team. And, of course, with the coming of the, well, park really didn't have anything to do with that, but it was more when they opened the homestead area. So that brought people in, so it brought traffic. And I had no way, of course, I'm not gonna, you know, I kept around 20 dogs. And I did sprint racing. And that was the dog lot, you know, out here. Well, I don't, now, you know, you never, there's dogs running around all the time. I won't even let my two little dogs loose at all outside. And I'm very cautious, even when I take them on a leash, they go with me to the post office, but I'm very cautious because there's a lot of loose dogs around. And I have the dogs that I, from the sled dogs, I sold my team because it was just too much traffic. One of the last scary was when I ended up, well, in order to get a trail, and I said more traffic here, in order to get a five-mile trail, I had to go, well, where the Park Service is now, the road. I had a trail there that would go to, down around the Copper River. Then I'd cross the road and come on back. There wasn't anyone living around here, and I could get 5 miles locally here. Or I could get my 12 miles in by starting out here, but I had to stay on the road till I got across the Solana River, and then I had a trail off to the right of the river. But the river doesn't freeze. and it's just too dangerous. You might be able to get across it one day and you might not the next. So basically, I would have to be on the road. But one of the days when I came back, just coming out of what goes up to the ranger station now, crossing the road, and of course on a hard surface, a snow hook isn't, you aren't going to hold a dog team. Right. Isn't going to do any good. So I'm turning, you know, to come in here. Well, here's an airplane. I ended up going under the wing of the plane landing. A plane had just landed and was taxiing into the Park Service there. Luckily, I had a good leader because he was trained. He would go on the right and come back, you know, so he'd go with the traffic. So we just kept going.
Wow. Yeah, that would be a little bit scary.
Yeah.
In talking about hunting, I'm wondering, in those, you know, the time period, the 60s to when you stopped guiding.
Yeah, early 80s, I guess. When, what year was, I don't know.
Around 1980.
Around 1980.
81.
Did you notice changes in the sheep populations and the other animals?
Yeah, I don't know the sheep. Say there were some very large sheep, and when more hunters started going in, and in fact, I think the park didn't open. In fact, maybe it's still open for ewe season, open season on any size sheep or anything like that. Yes, because what we did, you know, was very limited as far as the sheep, you know, to keep up the population, to keep up the size. I said the size has dwindled considerably. Of course, it's been years since I've been up there now.
Right. But so what do you mean you did things to limit? What do you mean by
we
that?
Took very, you know, the sheep hunter, it was very limited.
You only had a few clients.
A few clients, the number that we took, yeah.
Right. What about the moose and caribou and things like that?
That wasn't a main hunting or anything like that anyway. And of course, the caribou, I don't know how the population is there. Of course, you never know where they're going to be.
I was wondering, you mentioned about how, you know, clients would come for a certain amount of time and they had so many days and they wanted to get that animal in those days.
We like to encourage here, we encourage 21-day hunts. I should say hunts, or, you know, it was more the wilderness experience, too. Like I said, a lot of photography, and there was a lot of fishing, and it wasn't just hunting. But where clients were more anxious to go, I mean, where you end up with the problems is like, well, particularly the Alaska Peninsula, where you had to fly in, and we have to get out. Well, like, a lot of times, well, doctor, I've got to be back, and too bad. You aren't going to be back because of the weather.
Right. And so on a longer hunt, you had more opportunity to get the game.
Oh, maybe. Sure.
Did you always come home successful for your clients?
Usually. Yeah. So there's been several stories written, and Don has a couple books. They're, of course, out of print now. The O for a Life of Guide.
I read
and
that one, yeah.
All About Bear. And the other is A Log of the Yukon River. Of course, I'm sure that isn't any good now because of the, you know, the sandbars, everything changing continually. It was more for a guide for, you know, canoers and so on that were traveling on the river. Well, like I said, the work around here in order to make a living was not only the guiding and the outfitting. I had the art gallery. I have a couple coloring books out. It used to be a regular bus stop when there was, what was it, Alaska Yukon made regular trips. This was their bus stop. They would always come to the gallery, and usually in the summer, maybe I'd be giving demonstrations on filleting salmon or smoking salmon, because I usually had a fish wheel in. Of course, I was getting salmon at that time. My dog team as well. Yeah.
What did you use the team for? Mostly for the sprint racing only. Not for fun. Not utility.
No, fun.
Fun. That's always exercise. Good to have fun.
You have something fun to do when you're in the winter.
Something to get you outside in the winter is really important.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering about Slana as a community. I don't know. You call it a community?
I wouldn't call it a community. They try now, I guess, to call it a community, but I never thought of it as a community in years past because it really, you know, wasn't.
Yeah, in the wintertime, how many people would stay living in this area back in the 70s?
Pretty much. I don't know whether there's anybody besides here, you know. Most of the people aren't here year-round. That I'm set up, you know, and have no other home to go to. And, you know, it was year-round. And if you're going to be open in the site, you need to be here in the winter to keep things operating.
Right.
You can't just leave. Yeah, things that have helped or really changed. Internet, I says, is one of the big things that has changed things because, I guess, you say, it has helped me because not being able to leave or to get supplies, not only supplies, groceries, or anything like that, that's difficult. But one of the hardest thing is getting parts and maintenance things that I need. But I do most of it on the internet now.
That's great.
And thankful for Amazon because most of the other companies you cannot deal with. It's just a waste of time because they think Alaska is... we can't ship to Alaska, so
we're going to charge you twice as much to ship to Alaska.
Yeah. No way.
Shipping will cost more than the part.
Right.
Well, Mary Frances, it sounds like you're a very hard worker, determined woman with great perseverance to have lived out here by yourself for so long, and a woman guiding, that couldn't have been easy. It's like a pretty amazing life.
Yeah, and... guess it wasn't easy, but, you know, with the guiding, I did have a lot of the, and running the equipment, of course, I usually ran the cat into camp. I usually drove a tractor, but I had experience with it. You know, growing up, of course, I drove the truck and the tractor on the farm before I ever had a driver's license.
Right.
How did this come up? Because somebody asked me yesterday, you know, what age do you have a driver's license? the day I turned 16, you know.
But you've been driving before that, obviously.
Yeah. Right.
Well, yeah, it sounds like the...
So, you know, I had experience on the farm with the horses and everything, so I'd had quite a bit of experience, and 4-H gave me a lot of experience, and I showed cattle for many years.
Well, it sounds like it was a lifestyle that you enjoyed.
Certainly did, yeah.
Hard work.
Yeah. And it's changed. Like here now, my work is making, which I would like to get back. To my artwork, which is basically sort of impossible right now. I've had a number of pieces started, but I can't finish because I can't get to the foundry, and so it's just doing. I did do on with the internet. I built my own computer. And I have been doing some design there that I've had custom pillows and totes and throws custom woven. But again, this summer has been so busy, I can't even get the things out. Right. Like, this is one of my... And I, you know, do the custom designs and have them woven.
Yeah.
But I don't, you know... People have been ordering. I says, I haven't even had time to get them packaged.
Well, speaking of time, it's been very nice
thank you
to
very
spend
much.
So much time with us. I know this time of year is very busy, especially extra busy with the change of seasons.
Yeah.
So unless there's anything else you want to say about living here and guiding.
We could sort of wrap up.
We can wrap it up.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.